Hello, welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. From Flagstaff, I'm your volunteer reader, Deborah McFadder, with excerpts from Yes Media, a nonprofit, independent publisher of solutions journalism. This article is an excerpt, The Trees Are Speaking, by Linda V. Mapes, first published April 22, 2025. A beautiful color photograph begins this article. It's taken at the bottom of a large tree, maybe like a redwood or something, and we see in one quarter of the picture the rough bark of the trunk of the tree. But behind it, we see other trunks and the very, very tops of trees as if we're looking way up into the sky. Indigenous scientists are hurrying to learn what they can about intact old growth forests before they are gone. Biologist Teresa Ryan has seen a lot of clear cuts and loaded logging trucks, but this trucker was hauling logs down the mountain outside the remote logging outpost of Wasp, British Columbia, cut from trees so large the tractor trailer could carry only a few. "It's sad. I just feel heartbreak. Like a piece of me just went down the mountain," said Ryan, whose traditional name is Nyinghayisk, as the logging truck roared past her. "The ancestors are there. We actually used to put our people in the trees," she said, speaking of traditional burial practices of the Gitlin of the Tsimshian Nation. Ryan explained that her ancestors put the remains of their people in bent wood boxes and hoisted them into the trees, into the life of the forest. So when she said the ancestors were in those trees, just cut from the mountain where they had lived for centuries, she meant it literally. Ryan is an Indigenous Knowledge and Natural Science lecturer in the Department of Forest and Conservation Sciences at the University of British Columbia, UBC, Vancouver. I had joined her and Suzanne Simard, an eminent forest ecologist and professor in the same department at UBC, in these woods for a week of field work. Ryan and Simard had gone out on this logging road to find their crew, but right now that was out the window. They had to go see the clear cut those logs had come from. Ryan jumped in Simard's battered field truck, and I squeezed into the back seat with their clipboards, batteries, and gear for sampling and measuring trees. Simard bucked the truck up steep, rugged slopes to reach the top of the cut and killed the engine. We got out and looked around at the cut-over land, bare and baking in the July sun. A grapple skidder awaited the next day's haul of logs, and sawdust lay fresh over the ground. "This kind of machinery is devastating to the forest floor," Simard said, eyeing the carved-up ground, rutted and scraped to mineral soil. "And we are left with that. There is no carbon left, it's gone, and it's never coming back. It took 12,000 years to make this, and we have lost it in a snap of a finger." The air smelled sharply of ground-up fir needles. "You can't stop it. These trees are already down," Ryan said, assessing the stumps, slash, and logging debris. "It was coming straight at me," she said of the logging truck. "All I could see was the big logs. They were so huge." This cut was not exceptional. As we walked to the top of the cut-over hilltop and took in the landscape around us, we saw logging roads tracing through a maimed landscape into the far distance, mangy with clear cuts so large they covered entire mountainsides. "It's a tree hearse," Simard said of the logging truck as we walked back to her truck. "We are down to the last drops. It's a fucking graveyard out there. These are some big trees." "They were," she said, correcting herself. "There is nothing we can do. I know we can't save every tree, but we have to do a better job. We are going to need wood, but it should not be old growth. That was all cedar. It just makes me feel sick. And the fact we have seen it day after day after day all over the country, I'm sure those trees are 1,000 years old. People grow so numb to it. We all are." Ryan gathered a scarred piece of wood from the ground as we walked back to the truck. "We've got to burn this to honor the spirits, honor the ancestors," she said. As we headed down the mountain, a distant rumble filled the air. "Here comes another," Simard said, yanking the wheel to pull over to get out of the way of the log truck. After it passed, as we descended the mountain, ravens were circling and calling. "Stop," Ryan said. "Stop right now." Simer jerked the truck to a halt, and the ravens' calls filled the still air. "They are crying. Their home is being taken," said Ryan, who is of the raven clan. "Their nest trees are being destroyed. That is the mom. That is the baby. She's in shock." We just sat for a minute, quiet. Then Simard started back down the logging road, jouncing over the ruts. "It's so disrespectful to the mountain. It puts the mountain to shame. Our shame," Simard said, gathering speed past a numbered sign for the logging road. It was riddled with bullet holes. We made the long, bouncing drive down to the valley bottom, where we hoped to rendezvous with their crew in silence. Called the Mother Tree Crew, this was a team of researchers Simard had assembled in 2015 for a research project creating a time sequence of the annual amount of carbon stored in these clear cuts. In the first pass, the second pass, every time the loggers came back, they wanted to learn, through analysis of the soil and its layers, the toll taken by each cut compared to the original soil baseline condition. It shifts down and down and down. They will come back and plant it, and it will come back to that pale green, impoverished condition, a second growth stand, with no variety in the canopy, Simard explained. It was soil that started her career, and now soil had made her internationally famous as the author of the bestseller Finding the Mother Tree, which tells the story not only of Simard's scientific work, but also her struggle to overcome skepticism of her findings. Simard's lab explores the role of mycorrhizal fungi in connecting trees, one to the other, sharing nutrients and communication all around hubs of the largest trees she dubs mother trees. When her work was published in the journal Nature and popularized by the press as the Wood Wide Web, likening the networks to the Internet, Simard was suddenly an internationally famous scientist. Simard, who had labored in obscurity and hostility from industry and even her own colleagues, was a sensation with millions of views on her TED Talks and a crush of media attention. She bore the attention stoically, doing interview after interview for the sake of the forest, which, even as her notoriety grew, was still being cut down. Protests during the summer of 2021 against one logging operation near Ferry Creek at the south end of Vancouver Island sparked the largest civil disobedience in modern Canadian history, with more than 1,000 arrests of protesters trying to blockade the logging roads. They dug trenches in the dirt logging roads, cut into the sides of remote mountains, locked themselves to concrete blocks, and erected platforms in the middle of logging roads that they then locked themselves to. They camped in the canopy of towering firs. They hiked miles to the leading edge of the cut, where the loggers were dropped off by helicopter for their daily work, amid protesters leaping from the understory, blowing air horns. They wrote peace signs on the cut stumps with fresh sawdust scooped from a scarred ground next to gas cans left by the loggers for the next day's cutting. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police, backed by the courts, hauled away the protesters. The logging continued, but the provincial government of British Columbia was beginning to talk about deferring logging in some areas, with the effect of spurring even more logging. "They are cutting it faster and faster," Ryan said. "They've got to get it quick before it's locked up forever. They are cutting hill after hill. It's apocalyptic." Simard bumped over more logging roads until we saw the crew's work trucks. We parked and headed into the forest. We hopped from piece to piece of downed logs over inky black mud in a fructifying bog at the edge of the road, following a faint trace of the crew's path. In here, the light was soft, the ground even softer, and it was cool, even on this blazing July day. Fallen logs were crumbling back into the earth where they started as seedlings centuries ago. The logs were soft to the touch and furry with moss. Lush lichen grew over them, leafy as lettuce. The sunlight diffused through needles of hemlock and fir, and long shafts of gold late afternoon summer sunlight found canopy gaps and gilded the forest floor. Far above, a breeze was stirring green branches across the blue of the sky. Simard had found her research crew measuring giants in this old-growth stand. It was day's end and time to wrap up. When they had gathered their equipment, we headed back to camp. Makwala, the traditional name of Rande Cook, gathered us nightly in a circle after a camp dinner to reflect on the work underway. He is an artist and a hereditary chief for the Mamakakila, one of the 18 tribes of the Kwakwaka, whose territory reaches from northern Vancouver Island southeast to the middle of the island and includes smaller islands and inlets of Smith Sound, Queen Charlotte Strait, and Johnstone Strait. In 2022, Cook had invited Seimert and the other scientists, artists, filmmakers, indigenous knowledge keepers, and writers, including myself, to the second annual Tree of Life project for a week-long exploration of the old-growth forests in Kwakwaka territories. Founded by Cook as the Awinakola Tree of Life Foundation, he partnered with Seimert from the start. He saw parallels between his people's understanding of the connections between all living things and her work focusing on healing damaged forests. The goal on this trip was to share both new and ancient ways of understanding the land and to directly experience together the impact of industrial logging on the land, water, and native cultures. Right now, this is really about the next 100 years, Cook said in camp that first night. That 100 years doesn't belong to us. In a very short amount of time, the amount of damage we are doing is irreversible. It was time, he said, for a societal shift from devastation to regeneration. You are tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes Media. Seimert's goals were in alignment with Cook's to use indigenous, scientific, and artistic knowledge to understand and heal the forest. In her Mother Tree project based at UBC, Seimert and her team were assessing the biological and ecological status of clearcuts, comparing their soils with what they found in intact old-growth forests to get a sense of a baseline condition. They were like arboreal ambulance chasers, trying to stay one step ahead of the logging crews, searching out the last of the unprotected old growth in these lush river valley bottoms, hurrying to learn what they could of what intact old-growth forests look like and how they function before they are gone. We are trying to find old growth in these ravaged landscapes. All we find are rare patches, scraps perched on cliffs, Seimert said as we drove to the day's research site. The places the day trippers and vacationers to Vancouver Island rarely see. We will never know what we have lost. We are at a point in history where we can never understand what we once had, but there are still clues. What seeds are buried in the ground? What soils? That is what we are doing, trying to reconstruct what is there so we can heal these landscapes. This is the Vancouver Island off the main highway with its beauty stripped, hiding the views of the cutover slopes and valleys. We were in a hub of logging roads, logging signs, clear cuts, loading areas, and equipment yards. This land is hardly a forest at all anymore. It is a manufacturing plant for timber products, with remnant old growth stands and a sea of industrial tree farms on their third cutting. It is the nature of her work that Seimert has to drive through active logging areas to access her research plots. As we drove on, dust boiling behind us, the caravan of research trucks and the Tree of Life crew ground to a halt. There was a chain across the road. Active logging area, read the sign on the chain. We smelled it before we saw it, the unmistakable odor of ground-up, freshly cut trees. Those are old-growth trees, Seimert said, glancing at logs piled by the side of the road on the other side of the chain. She swung out of the truck to talk to the logging crew, to explain she needed them to let her and the rest of the crew pass. After a brief conversation, Seimert returned, dropped the cable to the ground, and the procession of vehicles drove through. We regrouped by the piles of logs heaped by the road to be taken away for milling. The cuts were fresh, weeping sap. The bark was still fragrant, the wood moist to the touch. "I'm just numb," said Cook. Logged on his people's unceded territory, a 500,000-acre swath of Vancouver Island. This displacement of his people from their lands, of the trees from their land, of the wildlife from their forest, continues the legacy of settler colonialism, Cook said. Nothing has changed since the beginning, he said. Those policies are designed for these actions to happen and for us to say something. We are the criminals. We are the disruptors. We are so conditioned by society to say, this is okay. We support this. I need an extension on my nice home. Why do you guys get in the way? Why are you so disruptive? Cook said he formed the Awinakola Tree of Life Foundation out of desperation and as a matter of cultural survival. We are watching our own traditional territory be wiped out, demolished. We are down to the last 2.7% of the old growth. We have got to get it all. It's sick to me. I think more and more it's like a panic that we are getting closer and closer to having nothing. But he wonders, who are we without our forests? How can we carry on if we don't have the connection to this land that's at my absolute core? It's severing our tie. Culture is not a performance, it's connection. That is how it is in our culture. We can't just sing and live disconnected in order for there to be new songs, for it to be a living culture. We kept going to get into the uncut forest to lay out some sample plots and dig. Simard led the way, walking right over the ridge on opposite side of the road from the heaped old-growth logs onto the trackless deep forest beyond. The steepness of the slope to the valley floor did not slow her. She was headed with her sampling crew to a place the maps showed should have what she called the white rhino of the forest, enormous, untouched, old-growth forest reigning supreme for centuries deep in the heart of the Titska Valley, unprotected yet still uncut. We made our way across the downed logs over streams, through bogs, the islands of forest floor in between the muck carpeted with sphagnum moss. The coolness coming off the Titska River reached us before we found the trees. Even on this hot mid-July day, it was so cool in the shade of giant hemlocks and Douglas firs. We kept our coats on. But the sun found us too, aglow through gaps in the canopy where big leaf and vine maple surged into the light. A goldfinch spangled in the sun, a brilliant yellow flash amid the river's sparkling blue. Excerpted from The Trees Are Speaking, Dispatches from the Salmon Forest by Linda V. Mapes with permission from the University of Washington Press. From the news section, an article entitled, How Including People with Disabilities Benefits Everyone by Lauren Schalisch, first published April 19, 2025. At the beginning, as usual, there's a photograph. This shows a woman walking with a white dog. The woman is dressed all in black, black tennis shoes, a black leather jacket, and long black hair. She's carrying the kind of cane that people who have visual problems would carry. The presence of employees with disabilities can make companies and organizations more collaborative, inclusive, and attractive to job seekers. Whether it's declaring that blindness prevents government employees from doing their jobs, or suggesting that hiring workers with intellectual disabilities contributed to Federal Aviation Administration safety lapses, the Trump administration has repeatedly questioned whether people with disabilities belong in the workplace. This stance reflects widespread stigma and misconceptions about what people with disabilities can and do accomplish. Negative stereotypes and exclusionary practices persist despite the fact that people with disabilities are the largest minority group in the United States, representing nearly 30% of the population. Whether or not you identify as disabled, most people live or work in close proximity to others with a disability. For years, I have researched how people with disabilities have been kept out of efforts to guarantee equal access for everybody, particularly in higher education. This exclusion is often due to unfounded beliefs about capacity, intellect, and merit, and the false premise that disability inclusion requires lowering standards. However, studies demonstrate that including people with disabilities is good for everyone, not just disabled people. Schools and workplaces are more collaborative and responsive when people with disabilities are included at all levels of the organization. In other words, disability inclusion isn't about charity, it's about making organizations work better. Now we see a picture of four people sitting at a table. One of them is in a wheelchair, and she is gesturing with her hands to the people across from her. There are two women and two men, and they are listening to her as she describes something that she's working on at her laptop. Rolling back protections. President Donald Trump issued executive orders the day he took office for a second time that aimed to end government and private sector efforts to make U.S. workplaces and schools more diverse, equitable, and inclusive. In addition to affecting LGBTQ communities and people of color, these measures could erode years of progress toward protecting the rights of people with disabilities to earn a living. Between 40 million and 80 million Americans identify as disabled. Even the higher end of this range underestimates the actual number of people with disabilities because some individuals choose not to identify that way or even realize they qualify as such. That includes people with impairments from chemical and pesticide exposure, as well as many older people and those who are living with HIV and AIDS, to name some examples. Only 15% of people with disabilities are born with their impairment, so most individuals became disabled over their lifetime. Tracing historical precedents. Blaming failures on people with disabilities and people of color echoes the harms embedded in eugenics, an attempt to scientifically prove genetic inferiority of disabled, LGBTQ, indigenous, and black people. Eugenics led to the institutionalization and forced sterilization of, and the coercive experimentation on, people with disabilities, immigrants, and people of color across the U.S. Even the Supreme Court endorsed the concept in the early 20th century. These studies began to fade after World War II, but their legacy persists. Even today, forced sterilization continues to be lawful in U.S. jurisdictions in 31 states and in Washington. Due to widespread activism and the advent of new legal protections, many states finally dismantled their eugenics policies in the late 1970s, but eugenics-era experiments provided foundations for contemporary medical research, standardized testing, and segregated school placements. People with disabilities have far-reaching legal guarantees of civil rights and access today due to the Americans with Disabilities Act. The statute, which was enacted in 1990 and strengthened in 2008, provided protections in the workplace, educational settings, transportation, and places of recreation and commerce, among others. It also guarded against negative perceptions of disability. For example, if an employer perceived someone as disabled and denied them consideration in the hiring process because of that, the candidate would be protected from discrimination under the ADA, whether or not they had a disability. While these advances are significant, many people with disabilities still do not have access to their basic civil rights. This is particularly true of Black people with disabilities, as they are disproportionately pushed out of school, disciplined more harshly, targeted for incarceration, and marginalized in disability representation and research. Gaining workplace accommodations. Critics of inclusion efforts sometimes wrongly argue that employing people with disabilities is too costly due to the accommodations they may require. But the Job Accommodation Network in the Department of Labor's Office of Disability Employment Policy found in 2023 that nearly 60% of these accommodations cost nothing. What's more, many tax incentives are available to cover these costs. Disability civil rights law does not mandate hiring people who are not qualified or lowering standards to include the disabled. The law requests the candidates meet the essential functions of the job in order to be hired. According to a 2024 Labor Department report, the employment rate for working-age people with disabilities was 38%, compared with 75% for non-disabled people. Though there are countless reasons for this disparity, many people with disabilities can and want to work, but employers don't give them the opportunity. Providing benefits for everyone. Many accommodations designed for people with disabilities also benefit others. Captioning on videos and movies was originally meant to benefit the deaf community, but it also helps multilingual speakers and people who simply are trying to follow the dialogue. Similarly, visual or written instructions assist people with depression, Down syndrome, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. But they can also make tasks more accessible for everyone, along with breaking assignments into smaller components. Sensory break rooms benefit people with autism and post-traumatic stress disorder, while also providing a reprieve in a noisy work environment and minimizing distractions. Remote work options can make it easier for people with chronic illnesses to be employed, and they similarly benefit others who may have caregiving responsibilities, helping attract and retain talented employees. Text-to-speech software provides people with cerebral palsy and non-speaking individuals with options for communication, similar to options that many people already use on their phones. A large body of research demonstrates the broad benefits of making jobs and schools more accessible to people with disabilities, which is ultimately an advantage for everyone. Studies on diversity in educational and workplace settings also demonstrate positive outcomes. In a study of 10 public universities, researchers found that students who reported positive, informal interactions with diverse peers had higher scores on measures of more complex thinking, a concern for the public good, and an interest in poverty issues, and were more likely to vote and develop strong leadership skills. In a national survey of human resources managers conducted in 2019, 92% of the respondents who were aware that one or more of their employees had a disability said those individuals performed the same or better than their peers who did not. Research published by the Harvard Business Review found many advantages to hiring people with disabilities. For one thing, people with disabilities can have unique insights that contribute to the workplace culture. The presence of employees with disabilities can make the environment of entire companies and organizations more collaborative. Earning a reputation for inclusiveness and social responsibility can improve customer relations and can give business an edge when they seek funding and recruit talented new employees. Ultimately, I believe it's important to create conditions where anyone can thrive, including people with disabilities. Doing so benefits everyone. This article is republished from The Conversation under a Creative Commons license. You have been tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes Media. From Flagstaff, I'm your volunteer reader, Deborah McFadder. Thanks a lot for listening.